As Philip said, today I'll be talking about a Lambda CDM bounce scenario. More about that shortly. And I should just point out that this is work that I did with Yifu Kai. Now, I think most people here work in or are interested in the field of quantum gravity, so I can go over this point relatively quickly. But one of the main difficulties of any theory of quantum gravity is to obtain predictions, which of course we want to be able to test them eventually, and to then confront them to experimental or observations. Because we expect quantum gravity to only be important at extremely high curvature scales, it's not obvious how we could have some effects which we can then test where we are here on Earth. So the best hope, at least in my opinion, appears to lie in the very early universe, where we do expect quantum gravity effects to be very important, and we also have some very high precision observations of the cosmic microwave background. So perhaps there are some of these quantum gravity effects that we could detect in the CMB. So the real question now, if we accept this perspective, is what form would these imprints have? So what would we expect the quantum gravity effects to look like in the cosmic microwave background? Now, of course, there's a whole host of approaches to studying quantum gravity effects in the early universe. And in this talk, I'll focus on one particular one, which is quantum cosmology. Before we get started, there is an important caveat which I have to point out. The dynamics of LQC depend on the matter content. And this is just like general relativity. You have to tell me what the matter field is in the space-time in order to solve for the dynamics. So the same is true in LQC. What this means is that the predictions of LQC strongly depend on what the dominant matter field is during the bounce. And so this could be radiation, it could be some inflaton field, it could be something else. So here, in the model which I'm describing here, I'll make a very specific choice of what of some guess of what the dominant matter field could well be. But the predictions that you get here really do depend on what the matter field is. I think it's just something that's important to point out. Because here I'll be talking about the predictions that come from LQC. And I want you to have in the back of your mind, well, this is a prediction for LQC if this is the dominant matter field at the bounce. So I'm looking at a model which is an alternative to inflation. So that means that the inflaton field, if there is one, doesn't play a role at the bounce. Now, if someone comes along and says, well, in inflation, we expect these corrections from LQC, that's also true. And we'll have different predictions. And that the difference between these predictions is due to our assumptions on the matter fields, not necessarily on LQC itself. So it's just to reiterate that point. No, so in this model, there's no inflation whatsoever. Yeah, okay. So as I think most people here know, we have extremely high precision observations of the temperature anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background, both by WMAP, by Planck, and many other experiments as well. And by measuring these, we see that the perturbations are nearly scale invariant with a slight red tilt. And so this is one of the main predictions that any cosmological model must offer. So inflation is the best known model of this type, which gives you scale invariant perturbations, but it's not the only one. And one alternative is the matter bounce scenario. So what happens in inflation is that you start with linear cosmological perturbation theory, and you can look at, since it's linear theory, you can just look at the Fourier modes. And what you find is that if you assume that your Fourier modes start off in the quantum vacuum state, as they exit the Hubble radius, they become scale invariant, which is what we see. So this is the key result of inflation. Now, it's also true that if you start out with Fourier modes which are in the quantum vacuum state, just as you would do in inflation, when these modes exit the Hubble radius in a contracting matter-dominated universe, they also become scale invariant. So there's a sort of duality between an expanding inflationary universe and a contracting matter-dominated universe. And this was first noticed by David Wands. Now, of course, this happens in a contracting branch. So this has nothing a priori to do with our universe today, which is expanding. But if you can connect this to the expanding universe via some sort of a bounce, the scale invariant perturbations that you generate in the contracting phase before the bounce can provide suitable initial conditions for the expanding branch after the bounce. So this is the key idea behind the matter bounce scenario. So this is really an alternative to inflation. There is no inflation after the bounce. We get our scale invariance in the contracting phase before the bounce. Okay, and I'll go through some of the calculations here later. So this is just meant to be an overview, slight introduction. And what I want to talk about today is a specific model, which I think is interesting because all that it has in this model are matter fields that we know are in the universe today. So we're going to have a radiation matter field, cold dark matter, and we're also going to assume the presence of a positive cosmological constant. So these are the three things that we have in our model. Yes? Right, so this was first noticed just in classical GR, looking at a contracting universe and not really worrying about the bounce. Now, you can get a bounce in a variety of ways. So people have shown that if you have various matter fields which violate the energy conditions in some specific ways, you can get a bounce. Similarly, if you just work with an F of R theory and you say, okay, I want some specific form of F of R such that I get a bounce, that's possible also. So there are different ways that you can get a bounce. What's nice about LQC is that a bounce comes out naturally. So you don't have to, you know, fine-tune the matter field or the gravitational sector. You just say, I'm going to work with LQC, and then that's it. But yes, it's important to keep in mind that here, well, I'm going to get to that in just a second, but here we'll work with LQC to get the bounce, but there are other ways to do that, depending on which prejudices you may have.
And any of these bounces will preserve this property of the scale invariant?
Not necessarily. That's something that you want to check. The models that have been looked at so far do, but as far as I'm aware of, there's no general statement. Any other questions? Okay. So, as I said in the previous slide, the modes that exit the sound horizon during matter domination in the contracting phase, we expect them to have a scale invariant spectrum. And what I'll show you later is that the modes that exit when the effective equation of state is slightly negative, so when you have matter domination, but the cosmological constant is affecting the equation of state just slightly, those modes will have a slight red tilt, which is exactly what we see in the cosmic microwave background. And as we were just talking about here, we'll assume that loop quantum cosmology captures the relevant high curvature dynamics, and then a bounce occurs at near Planck scales, and we can use the equations of loop quantum cosmology to evolve the perturbations through the bounce, and really show that the spectrum is preserved, as we must. And as I said, there are other ways to get a bounce, but here, I'm just going to focus on LQC. Okay. So this is the outline of my talk. First, I'll just look at the homogeneous background of this model. Then I'll look at the perturbations, so solve the equations of motion for the perturbations, and then finish by explaining what the predictions of this model are and how this model can be differentiated from inflation to start with, and then also from other bouncing models, which may come from other effects. Okay, so we'll start at the very, very beginning when we expect that we have a large contracting universe, which has a cosmological constant, cold dark matter, and radiation. Early on, radiation will be completely subdominant, just like it is today in our expanding universe. And so we can really just focus on the lambda CDM era. So we'll start off at some time here where the cosmological constant will dominate the dynamics, as we see in the blue line. And as the universe contracts, the matter field will become more and more important. And at some point, there'll be a transition between these two epochs. And close to that transition time, there'll be a brief period when the effective equation of state will be slightly negative. So if we had pure matter domination, the equation of state is zero. If we have a pure cosmological constant, the equation of state is minus one. So when we have a combination, it'll run between minus one and zero. And there'll be a small region here where our effective equation of state will not be quite zero, but just slightly negative. And this is the period that we're interested in, because the Fourier modes that exit the sound horizon at this time are those that will be nearly scale invariant with a very slight red tilt. Okay, and we'll come back to this later in the actual calculation. Now, after this, at some point, we expect radiation to dominate. And as I said earlier, in the high curvature regime, we're going to be using loop quantum cosmology. And we know what loop quantum cosmology for a radiation-dominated universe looks like. We get something like this. Okay, if we take a wave function in loop quantum cosmology, which is sharply peaked around a classical solution, and we evolve it back in time, we find that we get a bounce. So the classical solution here is just that the scale factor is proportional to the conformal time, so it's a linear function, and you have the Big Bang singularity here. What we have when we include loop quantum cosmology effects is that we have a bounce like this. The other nice thing that happens here is that if you have a sharply peaked state, then we have an effective equation which gives an excellent approximation to the dynamics for the expectation value. So we see here that we have some state which is sharply peaked. So the spread here really tells you how widely spread the state is. We can follow its evolution here. And you can also see the dotted blue line follows this evolution perfectly. Okay, so if we're only interested in the dynamics of the expectation value of the scale factor, then we can just use the effective equation, which is given here. And we see that this shows very obviously where the bounce occurs, which happens when the energy density of the matter field is equal to the critical energy density, which we typically expect to be of the order of the Planck energy density. So we like to explicitly solve the equations of motion so we know exactly what this universe looks like. Now, in order to do this, we could, of course, do it on a computer, but it's nice to have some analytical control, so we'll do some approximations. So the first part is that we'll split the evolution of the universe into two parts, the first part being the lambda CDM era, and then after that, radiation. Then we'll assume a constant equation of state during each of these eras. For radiation domination, of course, the effective equation of state is just 1/3. Now, during the lambda CDM era, we know that the effective equation of state is changing in time. So this, at first, may appear like a poor approximation. But what we have to keep in mind here is that what we're really interested in is calculating the form of the scalar perturbations in this model. And when you do this calculation, the key ingredient in knowing what form the scalar perturbations have is the equation of state when the Fourier mode that you're interested in exits the sound horizon. Okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to do a calculation for one Fourier mode, and we're going to say this Fourier mode exits the sound horizon when the effective equation of state is minus delta. So this delta is this small negative effective equation of state. And this will let us calculate the power spectrum of our scalar modes. So this is an approximation that we're using really because we know in the back of our mind that we want to get to the point where we can calculate the form of the spectrum of the scalar perturbations. And then we have these two eras, and we'll connect the two at the matter radiation equality time, sorry, there's equality is missing here, TE, by imposing continuity in the scale factor and in the Hubble rate. Okay? Now, once we do all this, we get this result here. Of course, we have some normalization choices to make. So first, we choose the bounce time to be at t equals 0. And we also choose the overall normalization of the scale factor so that the scale factor at the bounce is just 1. And then by using the approximations that I gave on the previous slide, this is the form of the scale factor during radiation domination. And during the lambda CDM era, it has this form. And here, the subscript E denotes the instant of matter radiation equality. Now, you don't have to worry about the exact form of eta 0. It's not very important. I just wanted to write this down so you see that we have absolute control over the solution once we make those approximations. Here, we see right away that the singularity is resolved. The scale factor does not go to 0 as t goes to 0. It's always has some minimal non-zero value. And we also see here that the scale factor during the matter domination goes like the conformal time squared with some small correction due to delta. So if it was just pure matter domination, we just have, it goes proportional to eta squared. Now we have this small correction. Yes? Yes, so here we're working in the topology of R3. So it's a non-compact space. That's right. And one last comment before we go on. I'm using two different time variables here. So t is proper time and eta is conformal time. And this is simply for the reason that in LQC, it turns out that the equations of motion are much simpler to solve in proper time, whereas the equations of motion for perturbations are much easier to solve in conformal time. So that's the reason for this disconnect here. But obviously, it's easy to go back and forth between one and the other. Okay. Now, the key ingredients in this model, which the predictions will depend upon, are the following. First, of course, as I've already said, it'll depend quite strongly on when the Fourier modes exit the sound horizon, what the effective equation of state is at that time, which I've parameterized by delta. Another important ingredient is the sound speed of cold dark matter, which we expect to be very small. This is usually approximated to be zero. Here, the fact that it's non-zero is important, but we do expect it to be very small, and we'll parameterize that by epsilon. The other two ingredients are the Hubble rate at the time of matter radiation equality. So at what point does radiation become more important than cold dark matter as far as the dynamics of the universe is concerned? And also the energy density of the radiation field at the bounce point in LHC. And that, as I said before, we expect to be the order of the Planck energy density. So these are the main things that the predictions of the model will depend on. Okay. Now, of course, what we want to do is that we want to calculate the spectrum of the scalar perturbations and then compare that with what we see in the CMB. So again, you could, of course, do this numerically, but it's nice to have analytical control over what you're doing. So we'll follow this procedure. So first, we solve the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation, which is the equation that governs the dynamics of scalar perturbations, in the lambda CDM background, where we assume a constant equation of state, as I explained earlier. The other input here is that we assume, as in inflation, that the perturbations are initially quantum vacuum fluctuations. Then we assume that there's a discontinuous transition between the lambda CDM era and radiation domination, right? So we move from lambda CDM to radiation domination in a discontinuous way. And we assume that this transition happens well before quantum gravity effects become important. So during this point, we can neglect any quantum gravity effects. They'll only become important during the bounce. Then we want to calculate the evolution of the perturbations through the bounce. And here, the modes that we're interested in are very long wavelength ones. So during the bounce, we can do all the calculations in the limit that are interested in the Fourier modes that are in the long wavelength limit. And this will simplify the calculations. And because of the discontinuity here, we have to figure out how the perturbations evolve between these two eras. And for that, we're just going to simply impose continuity in the variable and its time derivative. Here, for cosmological perturbation theory, a very convenient variable is this V. And so K just denotes that it's a Fourier mode. And this is called the Mukhanov-Sasaki variable. And so we'll impose that it be continuous and also its time derivative.
So what is the variable that is discontinuous?
So here, what we assume that's discontinuous is the effective equation of state. So we assume that it's minus delta for the lambda CDM era. Then we assume it's 1/3 for radiation. So that's what's discontinuous. And we ask that V, however, be continuous across that transition. Now, of course, you might ask, well, can't you just have some continuous transition here? And the answer is, of course, yes, that's what we expect. And you can do the calculations. But this is just an approximation which will give you a feel for what's going on. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, so the first step is to calculate what our scalar perturbations look like in the lambda CDM background. Now, this is a technical point which I raised with cosmologists. I'm not sure if this will mean a whole lot to you, but just to be complete, cosmologists usually talk about Fourier modes exiting the Hubble radius. Now, that's true when you're working with a scalar field as your matter field, because the sound speed of the scalar field is 1. What's really important, actually, is the sound horizon, which is the Hubble radius times the sound speed. Now, and the sound speed, remember, for cold dark matter, I said I would denote that by epsilon. Okay, so what that means is that in this model, your modes exit the sound horizon much earlier than you would expect if you're working with your intuition that it's the Hubble radius that's important rather than the sound horizon. But what's really important is the sound horizon. And that means that the scalar perturbations reach the long wavelength limit much earlier than you would expect. Now, the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation, which is what we use to study cosmological perturbations, has this following form in the lambda CDM background. So here we see the sound speed appearing here. And you can see if you just put delta equal to zero, what you'd have in a pure matter-dominated universe. So here you have some contributions from delta because of this slight departure from scale invariant, from zero equation of state. Now, the solution for this is the Hankel function. And if you assume that you have the quantum vacuum as your initial condition for the perturbation V, this is the form of your solution. So this is just your Hankel function with the index n, where n is approximately 3/2. Yes? So the initial vacuum is said to have the form like this. Exactly. So what you can see here is that in the distant past, when eta was very, very large, this term is entirely negligible, right? And you're just left with these two terms here, which is a simple harmonic oscillator. You know what the quantum theory for that is? You can solve it, and you can ask what's the ground state. And that ground state gives you initial conditions of this type. Okay, now for people who are cosmologists, you'll see that this is very similar to what you get in inflation also. And again, you have 3/2 plus a small correction. So this 3/2 will eventually lead to scale invariance, and this small correction will eventually lead to the slight red tilt. Okay, so we already see the key ingredients here already. Now we want to go through the bounce, and at the bounce, we expect the universe to be dominated by radiation. Now, when you have a radiation-dominated space-time, the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation is very simple. You don't even have the potential term that you had in the case of matter domination. So our solutions are simply plane waves, so cosines and sines. And what we do is that we require that V and its time derivative be continuous during the transition between the lambda CDM era and radiation, as I said earlier. And that tells you what form the numerical prefactors have to have. Okay? So I've given you precisely the form of the numerical prefactor of the cosine term. I've dropped overall numerical factors, which aren't too important here. And there's also some prefactors to the sine term, but these aren't important, because keep in mind that now we're going towards the bounce, which happens when eta is equal to zero. So you can see that when eta goes to zero, this term will become very small, right? And this term here will go towards one, and so this will be the dominant contribution here, okay? Now remember that eta e here is the conformal time of equality between matter and radiation domination, okay? So this thing here is just a constant, okay? All the time dependence is inside the argument of the cosine and the sine terms. Now again, if you are familiar with cosmological perturbation theory, then you know that to have scale invariance, you want to have k to the minus 3/2 here. Okay, so what you have here, and remember that n was approximately 3/2. So what we have here is that we have k to the minus 3/2 and k to the minus 5/2. And we also have this extra k dependence in the cosine and the sine. Now, this is not good, at least at first, because this term is not scale invariant, plus we expect to have oscillations, something that we don't see in the CMB. So we only get scale invariance if we impose that k times eta e is much, much less than 1, in which case this term becomes approximately 1, and this term becomes linear. And then you see that you get k to the minus 3/2 in both terms, which is scale invariant. Okay, so this condition is something which we'll impose, and later on I'll explain to you what this condition means. Okay, so this is the form that we have for the scalar perturbations during radiation domination before the bounce. Okay, now we want to go through the bounce, and to do that we need to use loop quantum cosmology. Now we want to study scalar perturbations in loop quantum cosmology, and a convenient way to do this is by using the separate universe approach. So what you can do is that you work on a lattice, and you assume that each cell is homogeneous and isotropic. This is necessary because in loop quantum cosmology, we know quite well how to quantize homogeneous spaces. It's much more difficult to quantize inhomogeneous spaces, and we don't fully understand how to do that yet. So what we can do is we can make an approximation where we just work on a lattice. We say, well, each cell here we'll assume is homogeneous and isotropic. And you let small variations occur between neighboring cells. So you do have perturbations, but these perturbations are small. Then, since each cell is homogeneous and isotropic, you can do a standard loop quantization in each cell. And luckily, it turns out that the interactions that come just in classical GR are very easy to handle in the loop framework. So you can do this, and you get a quantum theory. And from that quantum theory, you can derive effective equations. And you derive these effective equations in a very similar fashion to the way that we derived the effective equation for the homogeneous background earlier. So if we go back, yes? No, they do see each other. So you have each cell, which is homogeneous and isotropic, and then you have interaction terms between neighboring cells. Yeah, so that's important. Otherwise, you would have, they would just evolve separately and never talk to each other. Yeah. So here, we had the effective equation for the homogeneous background. And we can, following a similar procedure to how we found that, we can do the same thing for the scalar perturbations. And what that gives is this effective Mukhanov-Sasaki equation, which has this form. Okay, and actually, it turns out, a little surprisingly, that in the long wavelength limit, which is what I'm showing you here, if you allow for short wavelength terms, then you'll have an extra term which includes the gradient. So here, right, you have the gradient term that appears due to the interactions. But in the long wavelength limit, that term is negligible, and you're just left with this term here. Yes? Right, right, exactly. So you have to say that I'm interested in wavelengths which will have some. So you have, let me start from scratch here. So you have your space-time, and you split it up into some lattice. And depending on the lattice that you choose, if it's more coarse or more fine, you'll be able to describe a different number of Fourier modes, right? So if you make a very, very fine lattice, you'll be able to describe a lot of Fourier modes. If it's a very coarse lattice, you'll only be able to describe a few, right? So if you assume, for example, that you have a slight overdensity here, and a slight underdensity here, and a slight overdensity here, and a slight lower underdensity here, this is the shortest wavelength Fourier mode you can describe. That's right. So the physical wavelength will change because your universe is expanding or contracting. If you work in terms of conformal wavelengths, then it's constant, right? Because you can see that your wavelength will just change with a scale factor. So if you can mod that out, and then you work in conformal space, and then that's fixed. One thing which is important here is that this specific treatment, which I do here, breaks down for modes whose physical wavelength approaches the Planck length. So here, we're really assuming that the modes that we're interested in are always much larger than the Planck length. So this actually would not be a very good approximation for inflation. But here I'm not working with inflation. For the matter bounce, it's okay. Because... Exactly. But here, the modes that we see today, if the matter bounce is correct, they would have been much, much larger than the Planck length at the bounce. And so then this approximation is okay. But
then usually it says that quantum gravity effects are important in respect the effects on quantum inflation.
Right. Well, we expect. Right. So there are two, well, generally speaking, there are two main types of effects I think that we should expect from quantum gravity. One is when length scales are very small, right? So if we're looking at a wavelength which is close to the Planck length, we should expect some quantum gravity effects. And that will not happen here. There's no question about that. But I think we should also expect quantum gravity effects to occur when the space-time curvature is very large. And that will happen here. The background curvature is bounded, right? And here, this picture only works for small perturbations. So here, we're assuming that the background curvature is bounded. But, I mean, LQC just gives you that automatically. And this framework only works if the perturbations are small. So in that case, we do have bounded curvature, but that curvature can be very, very large. Yeah. No. Yeah. Is that okay? All right. And just one quick point. Well, I already said that we only expect this to work for Fourier modes that remain much larger than the Planck length. So we have this form, and surprisingly enough, this is exactly the form that you have classically, right? So this Z function is exactly what you find classically. The big difference is that now, the relationship between the Hubble rate and the energy density is different. So the classical Friedmann equation and the loop quantum cosmology Friedmann equations are different. So the simplifications you might have made classically, you can no longer make here. That's the main difference. But anyways, this is a differential equation which we can solve. So we do. And what we get is a hypergeometric function. I won't write it down here. Yes?
Yeah.
Well, so the form here is the same, right? So this is your differential equation, and this is your function z, right? So that's still the same as what you have classically. But the point is that the evolution of these quantities, right, which are all background quantities, is not what you have classically. That evolution in loop quantum cosmology is different, and so that will affect things. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. You can solve this differential equation. You get a hypergeometric function. And you can figure out the numerical prefactors just by matching with the solution during radiation domination in the classical era before quantum gravity effects become important. Okay, so the simple idea is that you're solving the differential equation at different times under different assumptions, and you're just matching it by requiring that V and its time derivative be continuous. Okay, and then at the end of all this, you can take the limit of the post-bounce era. You say, okay, I have this form of my perturbations. And then if I go in the post-bounce era, in the classical limit, when my time is much greater than the Planck time, this is the form of the scalar perturbations, which we should then be able to compare with what we see in the cosmic microwave background. And this is the form that we get. When we say that perturbations are scale invariant, what that means is that the right-hand side here does not depend on k. Okay? And when we say that it has a slight red tilt, what that means is that there's a slight dependence on k, which is negative. That's exactly what we find here, keeping in mind that delta is a small parameter. Also, typically, the variable this is usually expressed in is the co-moving curvature perturbation, because that's more closely related to what we observe in the sky, which is related to the variable we were using earlier, the Mukunov-Sack equation, just by an overall factor of the scale factor. Okay, so we just use V because it's more convenient for calculations, and the more relevant thing for observations is R, so we just translate back to that. And we also have an overall amplitude, which we see we have the critical energy density over the Planckian energy density. So we typically expect this factor to be of the order of 1. But we have the Hubble rate at the equality between matter domination and radiation domination. And that, in Planck units, we expect to be very small. So this predicts a small amplitude. Nonetheless, if you do have a small sound speed of cold dark matter, this can increase the amplitude a little bit. So we expect here a small amplitude with the exact value depending on the precise value of the Hubble rate and the sound speed of cold dark matter, which is, of course, what we observe. The fluctuations in the temperature and isotropies are very small. And just to remind you that here I have assumed that k times eta e, where eta e is the conformal time at matter radiation equality, is very small. Otherwise, you have those oscillatory features, which we don't see. So this is a necessary assumption here, which we'll come back to in a second. First, let me just talk about tensor perturbations. We can do a very similar calculation, and I won't go through it, but the result is that the amplitude of the tensor perturbations is predicted to be much smaller than the amplitude of scalar perturbations for two reasons. The first one is that the amplitude of the scalar perturbations are boosted by a factor of epsilon to the minus 3, as we saw here, right? So the amplitude is increased by this epsilon minus 3. And keep in mind that epsilon is a small parameter. And the sound speed for tensor perturbations is 1. So there is no boosting like that for the tensor perturbations. And secondly, the amplitude of the tensor perturbations is damped by a factor of a quarter during the bounce. And this is entirely due to LQC effects. So you can see what the value of R is before the bounce. Then as it goes through the bounce, it has a much smaller value afterwards. Okay, and this is a pure LQC effect. And what this gives at the end of the day is that the predicted tensor to scalar ratio, which is just a comparison between the amplitude of the tensor perturbations with the amplitude of the scalar perturbations, has the following form, which is quite small so long as the sound speed of cold dark matter is small. And this, of course, is in agreement with observations, which bound R by about 0.11. Yes, so I mean, there's a large number of inflationary scenarios, and some of them have been ruled out by that bound. Yeah. Well, the thing with inflation is in inflation, your scalar and tensor perturbations are generated after the bounce. So this effect of suppression during the bounce won't happen. So for, I don't think that loop quantum cosmology would modify the value of R for inflationary theories. So this comes back to what I was saying earlier, that the predictions of LQC really depend on the model that you're looking at. So I think this will happen in the majority of bouncing scenarios, where your perturbations are generated before the bounce. Then it'll go through the bounce, and this effect can occur. But if you have quantum vacuum fluctuations after the bounce, which are then give you scaling variance as they exit the Hubble radius during inflation, then there's no bounce afterwards for them to go through where LQC effects could damp it. Okay. So let's return to this condition that we had. Yes. Right. So what happens is that you have a similar equation for tensor perturbations. And if you have a constant equation of state here, that means that the pressure is just rho times some overall constant. Okay, and then in that case, you can write this as z goes approximately like a square root of rho over h. Now, classically, you can just cancel this out because the Friedmann equation tells you that h squared is equal to rho, modulo overall numerical prefactors. But now you can't because there are extra corrections from LQC. So what you get is that you have a over the square root of 1 minus rho over rho c, right? Simply because you have h squared is rho, 1 minus rho over rho c. So you have this. Now, you have a similar equation for tensor modes. You'll have something like mu prime prime minus, again, just in the long wavelength limit, zt prime prime over zt mu. Is equal to zero. Okay, and what happens is that zt has a different form. Zt has this form. Okay, so there's a 2 here rather than a 1. And what you can do is that then you can solve this differential equation, and you can see that the fact that you have a 2 here, what that does is that it damps the amplitude of your tensor perturbations during the bounce. If you want, I can just solve this explicitly for you after. It's not very. Yeah, so this becomes negative. Yes, but that's okay because V or mu are complex. So it's not a problem. Is that okay? Yeah, and so that's why here we're taking that here. Okay. So, as I said earlier, to have scale invariance, to avoid those oscillatory features in the CMB, which we don't observe, we have to impose that k a to e is much, much less than 1. But you can easily check that if we calculate k for modes that we observe in the CMB today, with a to e plus, what a to e plus is the conformal time of equality between matter and radiation in the expanding branch that we've observed. So we know what this is. Experimentally, we know what a to e is, a to e plus is. That is of the order of 1. Okay, so this is, so what this means is that the matter radiation equality time in the pre-bounce has to be much less than the matter radiation equality in the post-bounce branch. And what this means is that we need to have an asymmetric bounce where the radiation-dominated era lasts longer in the expanding branch than in the contracting branch. And what's interesting is that this has already been suggested to happen in LQC, simply coming from the effect of particle production during the bounce. So we expect that as we go through the bounce, there'll be some particle production, and that this could lead to a larger, a longer period of radiation domination after the bounce than before. Now, the real question here is how strong this effect is, and I'm not sure there's much known about that right now. How so? Yeah, so you could also have a particle production for CDM. That's true. But that really depends on your various models of what CDM should be and so on. It's certainly true that that effect could also occur, and we're not sure how they would compare. But I do think that it's quite clear that this effect for radiation should happen. For CDM, I'm not convinced because I don't really know what cold dark matter is. But the real question is how strong is this? And then it's true that if there is production of cold dark matter, maybe that would be a competing effect, and maybe that could be stronger also, in which case this wouldn't be viable. But this remains to be seen. But in any case, whether this is the the cause of it or not, for this model to be realistic, we really do need an asymmetric bounce. Otherwise, we just don't get scale invariance in this model. Let me finish with a couple more predictions of this model. Now, throughout the calculations, I assume that delta was constant, right? So I assume that the effective equation of state during the lambda CDM era was constant. But what we really expect it to happen is that it'll slowly grow as you approach the bounds. And since the longer wavelength modes exit the horizon before the small wavelength modes, we expect that the effective equation of state will be slightly larger as you increase k. Because what really matters for the scale dependence of k is the effective equation of state when that mode exits the sound horizon. And since the sound speed for tensor modes is larger, the tensor modes will exit the sound horizon much later than the scalar modes, right? But they have the same effect, right? That their scalar dependence, their dependence on k, depends on the effective equation of state when these modes exit. So since the tensor modes exit later, we expect that the tensor index be larger than the scalar index. And this one is just a matter of convention because pure scale invariance is defined to be 1 for NS and 0 for NT. So that's just an unfortunate coincidence. But here we would expect to have a less red tilt, or perhaps even a slight blue tilt compared to the slight red tilt of the scalar modes. So that's one prediction concerning the tilt of the tensor perturbations. But what's more important, I think, is the following one. We expect a running of the scalar index. That's just a question of how NS changes with K. Because your NS depends on your effective equation of state when those modes exit the horizon as follows. So your NS is just 1 minus 12 delta, and your effective equation of state is minus delta. And we just saw in the previous slide that this term here is necessarily positive. So what that means is that dNS by dK is positive. So this is called the positive running. So the lambda CDM bounce unambiguously predicts a positive running of the scalar index, which is the opposite of inflation. Inflation predicts a negative running of the scalar index. So this is a clear way to differentiate the two models based on observations. Now, observations are currently strongly in favor of inflation, so they really are predicting a negative running, but the observations are not finished yet, so a positive running has not yet been ruled out. It is possible that we have a slightly positive running. But if we get, if observations clearly show that this running is negative, then this rules the lambda CDM bounce out. Well, what happens is that as you go from, in the contracting branch, you go from a lambda domination period to a cold dark matter dominated period to a radiation dominated period. And this is just natural, right? Like so, and that means that your equation of state is going from minus 1 to 0 to a third, so it's increasing. To have a negative running, you need to have the opposite. You need to have an effective equation of state which is decreasing. And that's just not possible in this model. So this is something which inflation does naturally. It naturally gives you a negative running. So if this gains stronger evidence, then I would view that as being a very strong argument in favor of inflation. No. In this bouncing scenario. Yeah. There, so. Yes, so you could. Because what you would need to do is you need to have some period of time when the effective equation becomes smaller. Now, you could do this if you have some scalar field with a specific potential and you have the scalar field move around in that potential in a specific way. It's possible. But it may not be natural, but it is possible. So this does not rule out all bouncing models, but it does rule out this one where you're just including the matter fields that we know that we have. If you want to have a bouncing model which has a negative running, then you have to include other types of matter fields, for sure. Okay. Now, I started the beginning of my talk talking about quantum gravity effects. And most of what we did was talk about how these perturbations behave before the bounce. So a big question now is, are there any LQC effects? So in what I presented here, the bounce occurs due to LQC quantum gravity effects. But as Philip pointed out, you can also have bounces from other effects. So you could, for example, just include a matter field which violates your energy conditions. That can give you a bounce. Or you can consider various F of R theories, which also can give you a bounce. So what happens if you consider one of those rather than an LQC bounce? Now, most of the predictions are quite robust. So as we saw, most of the features of the spectrum are determined by the physics of the contracting branch far before any quantum gravity effects are important. So if you change the quantum gravity effects at the bounce, most of these predictions will not be affected. That's right. But those are the ones which we observe today.
Yes, but this is also because you assume that all the perturbations are linear. If you have non-linear perturbation, you see you can have some...
Sure. So you... Basically, if... What observations tend to show us when you look at the CMB is that perturbations, when the CMB was formed, appear to be very small. So you'd expect linear effects to be sufficient there. Now, it's true that you have nonlinear effects that grow after a certain time, but at small scales, I would expect that the nonlinear effects due to star formation and galaxy formation and so on to completely wipe out anything that was happening at very small scales. Maybe not, but it would be very hard to find something through that, I think. So most of the predictions depend only on the pre-bounce physics and very little on the bounce. But there is one important exception, and that's the fact that the amplitude of the tensor modes is suppressed by a factor of a quarter. So if you have a different bouncing model where the bounce occurs for some other reason than LQC, then you expect a larger value of R for a given sound speed of cold dark matter. And so if we have a strong reason to believe that the lambda CDM scenario is the correct way to generate the perturbations in the CMB that we see today, if, for example, we find a positive running of the scalar index, then that would be strong evidence for it, then we could then look at the value of R, hopefully measure the sound speed of cold dark matter, and then see whether you have the factor of a quarter that LQC predicts or not. So R is bounded by observations by 0.11.
Yeah, no, but no. I thought in your model you were predicting something that was very small.
No, well, small, but not very small. So this is what you expect here. So this is the LQC prediction, including the factor of a quarter. Now, this depends on the sound speed of cold dark matter. I'm not aware of any good estimates of it, but the one paper that I saw suggests that it could be of the order of 10 to the minus 2, in which case it would be close to around 0.1 here. But that really depends on the value of epsilon there. So if you have an extremely small value of epsilon, then yeah, you will not be able to detect it. But well, actually, there are, in this one paper I was just mentioning, I forget the reference, but I can get it to you if you're interested. They give a bound of epsilon being 3 times 10 to the minus 2. And if you put that in here, you would get R of 0.13. So you can see that if you're just slightly below the upper bound, then you're below this observational bound here. So you're okay. But it is true that if your sound speed is much smaller than that, then we'll have trouble observing this. But if we can observe it, then this damping factor of 1/4 could be a way to test LQC. Yes? The F of R theories typically, and I'm not an expert on this, so I could be wrong, but typically they as far as I'm aware, they don't really change the factors here. So here you wouldn't have this term. So this denominator here, which is what causes the damping. So there, but that depends on the F of R theory, because each time you do F of R, you have to redo cosmological theory and then cosmological perturbation theory. So in principle, yeah, perhaps you could get an F of R theory which predicts similar damping. But yeah, I'm not aware of any theories that have been studied so far that do that. But in principle, maybe. So let me conclude. So in the lambda CDM bounce scenario, which I presented today, if we start with quantum vacuum fluctuations, they become nearly scale invariant. And the Fourier modes that exit the sound horizon, when the effective equation of state is slightly negative, will have a slight red tilt, which is exactly what we see in the CMB. This model does require an asymmetric bounce, and it makes three important predictions beyond scale invariance. So a small tensor to scalar ratio, a positive running of NS, and NT greater than NS minus 1. And I really think here that the most important one is the positive running of NS, because that's something which is on the verge of being observed to good precision. And when that is, that will clearly allow us to differentiate between inflation and this model. And finally, there is an LQC-specific effect of an extra damping of the tensor to scalar ratio by a factor of a quarter, which could give us a test for LQC. Let me briefly finish with some open questions which haven't been addressed yet. The first one concerns the amplitude of the running of NS. So we show that the running is positive, but to actually calculate the amplitude, we really need to know the details of the pre-bounce era. So depending on the physics of the pre-bounce era, that will affect the amplitude of this. And so to know what the predicted amplitude is, we really need to understand that a little bit better. I already mentioned particle production. We do expect this to happen at the bounce, but will there be enough particle production to obtain sufficient asymmetry? Or will there be some effects from cold dark matter which may come in and ruin this effect? So this is another open question. And I've left the most difficult one to the end. In a bouncing model, if you don't have an ekparotic phase, we expect the anisotropies to really dominate the physics. Here I've only worked in a Friedmann universe where there are no anisotropies. So if we include anisotropies, how will that change the predictions? And this is a huge question. There's very little work done on cosmological perturbation theory, even classically, on an anisotropic background. And so this is something which I think really should be addressed and could teach us a lot about what's going on there. So on that note, let me thank you for your attention. You mean classically or in the quantum theory? Okay, so what happens is that classically you can just look at the tensor modes and you'll get drive their equations of motion and you get something which is similar. Now the question is, in the quantum theory, how can you handle them? And this is actually a little tricky because you can't use a separate universe approach like this because these things have indexes. It depends on more on just the over and under density of the energy density of the matter fields. So what you can do is you can look at effective equations. And there's an effective framework that exists to study perturbation theory. And you can look at that and you can derive effective equations for scalar modes, vector modes, and tensor modes. And this, at first, may not appear to be the same thing as the separate universe approach, which I presented here. But it turns out that if you look at the equations of motion for scalar perturbations that you get following that procedure, they're exactly what you get by using the separate universe approach. So that's encouraging. So that made me think, OK, well, maybe I should trust this. And then following that same procedure, you get effective equations for the tensor modes, which are of that form that I wrote over there. And you can solve those.
Done here is for the k equals 0 model.
That's right.
So would anything change if you look
good?
You can add spatial curvature. The main thing that will do will make the calculations a lot more complicated. Unlike anisotropies, spatial curvature is expected to be relatively, if you just do spatial curvature as in like a closed or open Friedman universe, that's expected to be quite small because you have, you have your Friedman equation, which goes as some radiation over a to the fourth. Let me just plus your anisotropies over a to the sixth plus your spatial curvature, which is k over a squared. So at the bounce, radiation will be very important. Anisotropy is even more important, but your scalar curvature is pretty negligible. So you certainly can include it, but it makes calculations a lot more involved, and we don't expect it to dominate at the bounce. So.
Just to understand more the prediction you made concerning the sign.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that if we show explicitly that it's great and it's negative, this would mean that all this bonding scenario, just rule out?
So this model that I presented today is ruled out for sure. You can still have a bounce and generate your scale invariance after the bounce. So for example, if you have inflation, you can have a bounce and then have inflation occur, and then you'll have scale invariance. So you still have a bouncing model that gives you scale invariant perturbations with the positive running, because your scale invariant perturbations were generated after the bounce. Yeah. So that's also still viable. The cases when you generate your scalar perturbations before the bounce, as I said, it is possible to build it up so that you get it, but these things appear to be entropically disfavored, which is not to say impossible. But I think if we really do detect a negative running, then the models where your scalar perturbations are generated before the bounce have a very strong requirement of showing that they can get a negative running, hopefully in a natural way. There's obviously a possibility to just cook up a scenario by fine-tuning your initial conditions to get it, but for it to come out in a nice way might be difficult. May not be impossible, but it's not. I think it would be a big ask for these theories.
So that's
quite a big
prediction.
Potentially.
Any further questions? If that's not the case, then let's thank Ed again.
Thank you.